Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is journalist Katie Buckler, who was a San Francisco Chronicle staff reporter for 12 years and has written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, and Vogue. But her life changed when she witnessed the prolonged suffering and intense medical intervention done on behalf of her father during the end of his life. That story was recounted in her bestseller, Knocking on Heaven's Door. Since that time, she's spoken at Harvard Medical School, the Kaiser Permanente, and before other medical professional and patient advocate groups on doctor-patient communication and the choices family face near the end of life and how to talk to them about that. Katie Butler writes, a 2017 poll found that only a quarter of the population wants to live the longest life possible. The rest cared more about the quality of their lives and deaths. Yet today, 17% of Americans will die in an ICU, and over a third will spend time there during their last months. Katie Butler's new book, The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life, is a primer for those who want a good quality of life and the least amount of prolonged suffering during death. And the preparation begins far earlier than most of us want to think about. The book is inspired by the medieval death manual Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying, but it's written for contemporary life and medicine, and it offers recommendations of the steps you can take and issues to be thinking about and acting on in the final third of life. Katie Butler is my guest today. Katie Butler, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Rich. I'm really happy to be here.
This book follows up on Knocking on Heaven's Door, which combined your family's personal story about the death of your parents and your father particularly, as well as some of the information you share again in The Art of Dying Well. Why did you decide to write this book?
I really wanted to write a book about solutions. I felt that the first book was in some ways a very well-articulated complaint about what's wrong with modern medicine. And so many people got in touch with me afterwards with their own particular medical dilemmas that I realized we need some workarounds to our broken systems, and I wanted to gather stories from people who had gone through this process well. So I actually talked to hundreds of people about good and difficult deaths they'd experienced, and also people who were thriving in later life and how they're coping with the changes and navigating these changes.
Well, you write that because people in the developed world, and really I would say a lot of the developing world as well, don't have to consider death until the upper reaches of their lifespan, We often find ourselves in a death situation unprepared. And I guess the point of this book seems to be preparation, is it?
Exactly. It's to start to illuminate this landscape that I call the gray zone that stretches from active living to active dying. There's a long process now of decline in between those two points for many, many people in developed countries with highly technological medicines. So I wanted to create a map for that time. I wanted to help people navigate the pitfalls of modern medicine. And my feeling was that ignorance makes us very afraid. And that if we have some clarity about the landscape and we have some tools to do planning with, we can be much less afraid, we can worry less, and we can be more empowered.
Really, you also want us to think about death, which, you know, we don't want to think about death, and we certainly don't want to talk about it, but that's really a big part of this, isn't it?
It really is. You know, there's a whole movement called the death cafes where people just get together over muffins and talk about death. And death over dinner, there's another movement called that. I think we need to start thinking about imagining what a good death would look like for us and then work back from there, because it's not automatic. It's not enough to just say, I want to die at home, or take me out and shoot me if I get like this. That's not enough. You actually have to make plans to get from A to B, and that's what I hope the book helps people do.
If I remember right, I think that was something a family member said to you, you know, just take me out and shoot me if I'm, you know,
a lot of people say that.
Countless families have heard that.
And
Who's responsible for starting these conversations? Because I think a lot of times the children feel like they're supposed to, but isn't it on us to start these conversations?
Well, I think it's a mutual responsibility because we all have a stake in it. Our younger family members are going to have to bear the brunt of our caregiving and of our difficult medical decisions if we don't make our own and start talking about it. So both people have a stake. So if nobody's bringing it up, don't wait for somebody else to break the silence. That's my position. And if you're an older person yourself, you can start by saying, here's the music that I want played at my funeral. It's a nice, it's kind of a shallow end of the pool way of kind of starting to approach that. And sometimes you have to bring this stuff up repeatedly because the first reaction is, oh, no, Mom, don't be morbid, right? And you're not being morbid if you're 85 and you say, I only think I'm going to live another 5 years. Maybe you're just being realistic. And on the other end of it, it's really talking about what's a high quality of life for you. Or if you're a family member, you might say, Mom, I really need you to relieve my anxiety. I am worried about what kind of decisions I might have to make if you become incapacitated, even temporarily. If you frame it like that so that that older person is doing you a favor by talking about it, maybe you'll get a little further.
And I think the idea, one of the big ideas in this book is that you advocate thinking about death far earlier than most people would consider or want to.
Yes. Yes,
I do. And I think, and that brings up these issues that you've just talked about even in a greater depth, because if, you know, you're in your early to mid-60s and still feeling very active and feeling great in life, and you're starting to think about these things and you're starting to tell your family members about it, they begin to get worried. You know, they're thinking, what's going on?
Isn't that funny? How we got here as a culture, I just don't understand. All of our great religious traditions have talked about getting comfortable with the notion of dying. They consider it an act of spiritual maturity. In the Rosh Hashanah service every year, people recite, man is like the grass that withers, the flower that fades, like a fleeting cloud. It's actually very, like a dream that vanishes. They're very, very beautiful lines, and Buddhists have similar lines, but somehow we've got amnesia about this. So I think we need to both reassure our family members and also talk about it at the same time. Within the palliative care movement, they often talk about have a plan B or hope for the best, but plan for the worst. These are very sort of helpful little truisms to help us get prepared.
So when should we start thinking about how we want the end of our life to go? In the book, you have these different stages, and the first stage you talk about is resilience. When you're really still getting around great, but this is, no issues of physical health, no mental decline.
But exactly. This could be early 50s. Mm-hmm. It could be later if you're extraordinarily healthy. But it's a point where you're no longer in that, that high noon of life. Maybe your joints are starting to hurt, or you need a little more sleep, or you're not sleeping quite as well, or your back aches a little more than it used to, or you sprain an ankle, it takes a lot longer for it to recover than it used to. You just get these little hints, these little inklings. The experts in end-of-life care say you should be signing your advance directives in your 20s, because that's when you might have a drug overdose, or you might be in a car crash and have very significant brain damage, and you really want to have thought it through then, but realistically, a lot of people are not going to do it. But when you first have those first tiny raps on the door, whether it's those gray hairs or those wrinkles, I think that's the time. That's the time to sign your first advance directive if you are up to it. And there's a wonderful one called Five Wishes, which you can find online, which is not as intimidating and medicalese-driven as many of the official ones.
What are Five Wishes?
The Five Wishes are things like how I want to be treated while I'm dying, who I want to speak for me if I can't speak for myself. And each one in that document is very beautifully laid out. So it includes things like, I would like my body to be kept clean and comfortable. I would like to be massaged with oil. I don't mind you giving me painkillers, even if it makes me drowsy, because it's important to me that my pain is controlled. So it's very reassuring and gentle document. And then at the very end, it also deals with such issues as, I don't want to be intubated if I'm within 6 months of dying. So it's so user-friendly. I really advise it for people.
Well, that first stage in resilience, and in each section of the book, you have a few statements that tell us, this gives us a sense of whether you're speaking to us.
For right. Example, I thought of the book as a book you could skip around in.
Yeah.
You want to read about resilience if you're in that stage, but maybe if you're more advanced, you might want to read the House of Cards chapter, which talks about people in a much more frail stage of life, or adapting to disability if that's what you're facing right now. And each chapter they show an arc, but each chapter also stands alone.
So what are some of the key things to keep in mind? You mentioned the House of Cards. This is, gets into frailty. Frailty could happen at any age. It could be you could be in your early 60s. You could be in your early 80s when it strikes, or even older.
That's right, or you might escape from his life with almost no time there at all. Almost all of us want what I call the Niagara Falls trajectory, highest possible quality of life, followed by let's go over the waterfall fast and go down and out of here as fast as we can. We're not all going to get that. But you're going to maximize your time at the top of the waterfall if you reverse these reversible health conditions in the resilience phase. I was astonished to find out that you can be over 65, and if you get in shape and or you change your diet, you can actually make really significant changes in what that trajectory is going to look like for you. And for me, the goal is to postpone disability. It's not to postpone death. So half an hour of vigorous exercise a day for everybody is probably the number one thing you can do.
Let's talk about that House of Cards, because this becomes a real critical time.
Yes.
When you have become frail, this is the time when serious interventions often will be done on you. And it's very, it sounds like from what you write, it is very critical that you think very carefully about what interventions you want to take and what you don't want to take at that particular point.
Exactly. This House of Cards time is a place where you usually come back from a hospital stay worse off, not better. In the book, I have a guy who cycles 9 times in his last year of life between ER, ambulance, hospital stay, nursing home, and then back to his assisted living in worse shape than when he started. You want to try to get medical care at home if you possibly can at this stage, physician house calls, nurse house calls. These things, it's a travesty that we don't have them available for everybody in this frail stage, precarious health. Almost any medical intervention at this point is likely to have disastrous results.
That might surprise most people. And you use a case study in the book in which this person had an advocate for them who knew of the risk. And it was, in this case, his father had become very frail in just the last couple of years. He'd been robust earlier, but had become frail. And it was determined that he had some blockage in his aorta.
Oh, yeah.
And they wanted a very invasive surgery. And the son said, I don't think that's the right move. And so let's do a less invasive, thinking, okay, we're going to try to minimize the stress. Well, at least in this particular case, and we realize this is just a single case, that made no difference. It was less invasive. It fixed the problem, but it did not fix the person.
Exactly. And the irony here is that the son was a doctor, highly experienced in this area. So his dad was kind of shuffling along on a walker before this procedure, which was to widen a valve in his heart. And the procedure worked great. He, you know, the fluid came off his legs. His heart was better. But because of the stress of this outpatient procedure, he became confused. He was sleeping more and more hours a day. As a result of this confusion and the sedentariness, he then lost muscle mass, and he became incapable of getting himself in and out of a chair. And so the next thing you know, he's bedridden, and he died 9 months later. He would have been better off putting up with the damaged heart in the state it was and not having that procedure. And when you end up in a hospital and you have the stress of being woken up in the middle of the night with vital signs and noise and no fresh air and terrible food, these are difficult for a younger person, but they can be absolutely devastating for an older person in this fragile stale.
What are some of the best ways to avoid medical overtreatment, especially when you're at this, maybe not necessarily as frail as that person, but still in a position where a surgery, a major surgery, is, you know, a coin flip on whether it's going to absolutely help you or make you worse?
I think one of the most important ways, if you can find one, is to have a geriatrics doctor. These are specialists in the aging body. They're specialists in taking time with you and looking at the whole big picture instead of a lot of fragmented broken parts. If you can get into a good Medicare Advantage program or HMO like the Kaiser systems, these programs do a lot better approaching the end of life. They're much more conservative about the medical care they recommend because they don't have an incentive. You know, every independent surgeon has an incentive to do surgery. And in a larger system like this, things are more rational and more evidence-based. So those are the two things I recommend most. You need someone looking at the big picture. And then you need to ask questions like, what will happen if we just don't do this surgery? What if we just watch and wait? Or if it's about a test, to just simply say, is taking this test going to change our decisions about my treatment? Because if they're not, then let's just skip the test. You have to develop a sort of, I don't know, discernment and a certain degree of moxie.
Right. I was really struck by something you wrote in the book, says, you know, screenings for people over 50, and really, and I think this screening, you're talking about 75 or 80, and that's the colonoscopy. And everybody talks about the need for colonoscopies. Yes, they are very important, but if you're 75, just anesthesia is a big risk.
That's right, and the risk of, which is a minor risk, but the risk of a perforated colon will have a much more devastating effect on your health than it will for a younger person. So I recommend something called the FIT test, which is just a little gooey test you do at home and mail in a sample. It tests whether there's any blood content in your stool. Better to have a FIT test every year and avoid a colonoscopy over the age of 75. Colonoscopies are wonderful if you're younger, because if you remove those little polyps, you prevent something from progressing to cancer. But if you're over 75 or 80, those things grow so slowly that you're going to die with it, not of it. You're going to die of something else first. So I recommend really taking a very hard look about whether that's a risk that you really want to take.
My guest today is Katie Butler. She's a journalist and the author of the bestseller Knocking on Heaven's Door. Her latest book is titled The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. One of the things you write about, you know, towards the end stages when you're preparing for good death, active dying, hospice, and this has become a loaded term now because hospice means you're at the end of your life, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, does it?
No, and actually, when we were talking about overtreatment, that's another way to avoid overtreatment and cycles of hospitalization is get on hospice sooner rather than later. It's a 6-month benefit at a minimum. Explore it early on, even if you don't feel you're ready to commit yet. It's very unfortunate that half the people who go on hospice are only there for like 2 weeks, when you actually get a panoply of home-delivered team services that people just sigh with relief once hospice comes in. And they often say, I wish I had called sooner. And the strange thing is, they get such good health care that 15% of people disenroll from hospice because they do so much better under hospice care that their lives are actually prolonged. There's a story of a woman in my book who is literally on the edge of death's door getting chemo. She's in her late 80s and she has pancreatic cancer, which is a fatal cancer. And she leaves this harrowing chemotherapy program, goes on hospice. She recovers and she lives another 9 months. She gets better medical care under hospice than she was getting beforehand. So don't be afraid of hospice. Death doesn't decide whether to come for us or not on the basis of whether or not we agree. If you can face the reality of the coming of death, you can plan for it, and you can even have a higher quality of life in your last months. I think it's also a wonderful thing if you can ask a doctor to draw like a little stock market chart for you of what your trajectory to the end of life looks like. Because each of these different diseases has kind of a signature pattern. Sometimes it's a looping decline. Sometimes it's like the dwindles. It just fades away slowly. Sometimes it's like a stair step. If you have a little map like this, it can actually help you determine when is it time to turn. I say turn towards hospice as soon as you qualify. As soon as they let you in, get into hospice.
Now, people think of hospice as being a place you go for those last weeks or, you know, where your family are there. It is a nice atmosphere. You know, your body is shutting down, but that is not the case, is it?
There's a period in the book that I call active dying, but there's a period before that that I call preparing to die. And the woman I have in that section, the one with pancreatic cancer, she continues to work up to 6 weeks before she dies. She's very much encouraged by her hospice nurse to do so, to do what she loves. hospice is so good at pain control that people often function a lot better. So she was on morphine. She did have pain. She did have symptoms. But hospice addressed them one by one, and especially when people get on methadone or morphine or fentanyl close to the end of life, they actually function better.
It seems like there's an essential need for this information out there.
Yes, I talk a lot to medical centers as well as to community groups because I see myself as a bridge between these two foreign subcultures that don't understand each other very well anymore. And we need to be developing a common kitchen table language for this whole stage of life, something shared by doctors and patients, so that the patients feel more empowered to talk truthfully to their doctors about what they really value and want at this stage. And for doctors to adopt a kitchen table language that's less intimidating and less euphemistic so that patients really understand where they are at on this little chart toward the end of life. I was very surprised to learn in the course of researching the book that wanting to live as long as possible is only the major goal for about 23% of people. The rest care much, much more about things like not burdening their families financially, not burdening their families with tough medical decisions, being at peace spiritually, having loved ones around them, and for many, many people, dying at home. So we need to learn to speak up to our doctors and say, I want to make it clear to you, living as long as possible isn't my only goal. You know, if we really are approaching the end of my life, however long that endgame may be, I want to make sure I tell you what matters to me. I want to make sure I tell you what a good day is for me. I want to make sure I tell you that if I can't garden, I don't want to live anymore, or I want to let nature take its course. We've gotten so bound up in this intense medical language that I think we've lost touch with our gut sense and our common sense often. We need to start speaking from our heart to our doctors, and they need to start speaking from their hearts to us.
I think most people would say, I would like to die at home if they were confronted with that choice of where, you know, where do you want the end of your life to take place? You'd say dying at home surrounded by friends and family. How do we ensure that that's the best chance we have of that occurring? Because I think a majority of people would say that's the way they would want to go, but probably far more end up in nursing homes, or hospitals.
Right. A fifth of us die in ICU, which I think is just tragic. The people in the book who had the best deaths either had best deaths at home, either had money to hire caregivers, or they had a rich social network of friends. They had at least one person who was committed enough to really take ownership for the way things went in general. Or they had a very good government program. There are some excellent programs like the PACE program. The VA has an excellent program called Primary Care Delivered at Home. It's called Home-Based Primary Care. So there are those programs. There are physician house call programs across the country. There are scattered programs that really help people stay at home through this process of decline and make it more likely that you're going to die at home. So I really advise us to really build and rebuild our social networks constantly, to do favors for each other, to help people we know as they're going through the dying process. You know, you don't have to do everything, but if you just deliver a chicken dinner, you know, every Friday night, that's what I did for one friend of mine. You know, you don't have to make it backbreaking for yourself, but if a lot of people contribute just a little, it becomes much more bearable and possible.
You mentioned PACE. You describe that model as a new way of approaching end of life. And it's the story you tell is of Louise Manfredi, who was part of this program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. It sounded like an amazing program. And I was saying, this can't be everywhere. But tell us what PACE did.
It's heartbreaking to see what a beautiful death she had. And we all should have access to that level of care and beauty. She'd actually had a brain hemorrhage in her 50s, so she had a very long decline. And when she was 76, she ended up in this program called PACE, which provides every resource a family needs to keep a fragile loved one at home. So she got to go to a daycare program 3 times a week. Her husband got a break so he could keep the house going. meals were delivered, including weekend meals and including meals for him. As he started to decline, they actually came to the house and pureed food for her.
Wow.
Diapers were delivered. All the medications were put in like bubble wrap so you could just break, the husband could just break them out at the right time, all completely labeled by dose. All of these resources, plus they were encouraged to sign advance directives. And when she had a final pneumonia and ended up in the hospital, they had a very the PACE social worker. You know, it's again, it's a team approach. It's like hospice, but you don't have to be dying to be on it, okay? So the social worker convened a meeting, a family meeting in her hospital room, and things were heading south, and they could have a very, very conscious conversation. And the daughter could actually say, what we're trying to discuss here is what kind of a death are we going to give mom? And then she was transferred to a beautiful inpatient hospice unit with beautiful, it was more like a hotel than like some clinical medical faculty. And with beautiful views of the valley and places where the families could cook meals and eat together around a long table. And she had an absolutely beautiful death, including an orderly who stepped up and said, do you mind if I pray with your mom? And this was a hired hourly wage worker who also had a storefront church of his own. And he anointed her with oil and read to her from his Spanish Bible, and the family was very appreciative. So all of those humane, relational, and sacred qualities of dying were supported and brought back into the room by this amazing PACE program. Unfortunately, only about 40,000 people in the country are on the PACE program because you really have to have an altruistic group of people to start one. It's not a big money maker. And so there are only scattered communities throughout the country where these programs exist.
Are they exorbitantly expensive
to
run?
They're absolutely free to the participants.
Yes,
all the medical charges are included.
But I'm thinking of why it couldn't be widely modeled. Is it because the treatment is and the care is pretty expensive compared to what you would spend if you went through the usual emergency room, hospital, nursing home scenario?
Well, it costs the government about $70,000 a year to have someone on the PACE program. So usually people are on a combination of Medicaid and Medicare. And it actually saves the government money because people on Medicaid who end up in nursing homes, that's a bill that the government has to pay, and it's more than the PACE program. So it actually saves money. And I think it also saves money because it keeps people from this cycle of bouncing in and out of the ER and hospital stays. I mean, one guy in my book, I said, 9 times in his last year of life, and you know, the ambulance ride alone can be $4,000, and it can be $6,000 just to have tests run in the ER, even if nothing's wrong and you just send the person home. So there are these enormous leakage of inappropriately spent money that does nobody any good, and programs like PACE redirect that same money in ways that actually benefits families and the participants themselves. But unfortunately, as I said, it's not a big moneymaker. You're not going to get a medical center starting a PACE program because there's no profit in it. I hate to, you know, it's a cynical thing to say about our system, but I really think every major hospital system that is benefiting greatly from these very expensive, torturous end-of-life treatments like ICU stays should be forced to also be sponsoring a PACE program.
Journalist Katie Butler is the author of The Art of Dying Well, A Practical Guide to a Good End of Life. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.